Right, we're back today with part two of the Defeats of the Imperium. I was pleased to see that people are enjoying this series, but one thing I wanted to highlight was that there are, of course, many, many disasters and tragedies and failures throughout the Imperium of Man. So anything not chosen by me in these two videos, put it in the comments down below, and then we'll look at it in part three later down the line. Undoubtedly, we'll also get into the greatest victories of the Imperium at some point in time, but we'll cover that later as well. But for now, let's get into the remaining five choices from me. And also just a reminder to say that defeat and victory does not always have to mean a crushing physical battle. It can also mean a moral loss, or it can mean some kind of grave misjudgment on behalf of, say, Imperial administrators. The Invaders are a successor chapter of the Imperial Fists, and they exemplify some of the best or worst traits of their Primarch Rogue or Dawn, depending on your perspective. One such trait was their inability to accept defeat, and would take significant risks to stubbornly achieve their goals. In M41, the Invaders launched a major assault upon the Eldar craftworld of Idharre, or however you pronounce it. Many craftworld exist beyond the most well-known craftworld of the Eldari, and Idharre was one of the minor craftworld. The Eldar who lived upon this craftworld had already been significantly reduced in number, as they had just suffered greatly at the bioforms known as Tyranids. Worse would come for them though, as the Invaders launched their assault upon the already relatively crippled craftworld, not the most honourable actions, but Xenos as Xenos. Stranger still was the fact that the mysterious Legion of the Damned would appear here to aid the Invaders in their quest, which is an odd situation for them to appear in. Usually the Legion of the Damned only appear when critical knife-edge engagements are at hand, and this doesn't seem to be one of those situations. There was not much to be lost or gained here by the destruction of such a minor craft world, but regardless, they played a role. It would be the destruction of the Great Dome, that is, the protective bubble that enables the craft world to exist as a living planetoid vessel, and the destruction of this dome would turn the craft world into a dead, drifting space hulk, a desiccated, lifeless form of wraithbone. Such a brazen act of wanton brutality would not be quickly forgotten by the Eldar, especially when other craftworld began to hear of such dishonourable actions. It was akin to brutalising a wounded soldier on a battlefield, but what else do you expect of Monkey though? It would be some 40 years before the Eldar would exact their vengeance upon the Invaders. One of the major craftworlds, Aletok, would teach these rough barbarians what their actions would cost them. And they would pay heavily for their crimes. The attack would come at the Invaders' homeworld of Ogris, and this time it would be the Astartes who were under strength, as they were still recovering from the losses they had taken in destroying the craft world itself. The forces of Aletok, along with the few survivors from the craft world the Invaders had destroyed, rained down fury and hellfire, along with vast phantom titans and all manner of skimmers and assault strike ships. The ferocity and scale of the assault crippled the Invaders in no time at all, and their fortress monastery was completely annihilated. Only 300 Astartes survived after the battle, and the scale of destruction on their home planet left them to conclude they could no longer remain here, and would instead take to the stars in the remaining ships that they still had and were operational. The Invaders have recently only been able to operate in supporting other chapters' actions 100 years after their monastery was destroyed. Much of their chapter war gear and honours lost for all time, and they are still far from operating close to full strength. The Invaders' tale is a simple one, and one which could be played out across anywhere really in the Imperium, but it's a crushing defeat nonetheless. And as we see throughout the examples of Space Marines being as powerful as they are, but are no less vulnerable to complete annihilation than any other force, the Imperial Fists learn this themselves, and some chapters have already come close to near full eradication several times over. The lesson for the Invaders though was that all actions have consequences, even if it takes decades to come back around to you. The Black Consuls are a second founding of the Ultramarines, known for staunchly adhering to the Codex tenets laid down by the Ultramarines Primarch. And the Consuls were originally a fleet-based chapter, that is to say they utilised a space fortress monastery to operate from. However, this would be destroyed by Dark Eldar sometime in Millennium 40. With their fortress destroyed, they were forced to find a planet to found as their homeworld and settled on Cyclopia, an Imperial Hive planet in the Calixus sector. The Black Consuls would then proceed to lay waste to the Dark Elder in a bitter campaign of vengeance during a 300-year xenocidal purging spanning multiple star systems and collapsing an entire sub-dimension of the Webway. However, the Black Consuls were to suffer far worse devastation than they had at the hands of the Dark Eldar in the year 455, Millennium 41. For upon returning to their new homeworld of Cyclopia, they were forced to defend against a siege upon Hive Godeth, orchestrated by either the Iron Warriors or the Wordbearers. Accounts are unclear, and both traitor marine forces of Chaos Undivided have been reported as being involved. It's possible either or even both were present. Regardless though, it seems that the Black Consuls were likely successful in repelling the siege by the Chaos forces, but that ultimately the traitors were forced to detonate the nucleonic stacks within Hive Godeth in a final act of defiance which would result in an apocalyptic nuclear detonation, vaporizing much of the Hive as well as all of its inhabitants, any remaining invaders, and far worse, the majority of the Black Consuls chapter. For a Space Marine chapter to suffer such catastrophic losses in one battle is a miserable and crushing blow to the Imperium. The chances are that suffering such a loss could indeed lead to the dissolution of a chapter, especially if it's a successor chapter. However you look at it, the Black Consuls failed, and failed badly. They allowed the traitors to obliterate millions, if not billions, of Imperial citizens, and far worse, near total annihilation of an Astartes chapter. The only crumbs of comfort for the Black Consuls would be that it is rare for an entire Space Marine chapter to be present on any one engagement, even if this is in the defense of a homeworld. This is because Marines may have been detached in squads to assist in other duties or part of cooperative composite Space Marine forces elsewhere. They may be out of communications, and indeed it might take them years to actually find out and discover what has occurred. When a chapter is broken though, so dramatically as the Black Consuls, they would always have to then regroup and assess their situation. If rebuilding the chapter is possible, they would attempt to do so. But otherwise, they may decide instead to dissolve and maybe commit their services to organizations like the Death Watch. The Black Consuls seem to have weathered this devastating loss, however, as they were reported as being involved in the attempted but ultimately failed defense of Cadia. They are reported as having been brought back to full strength through reinforcements of Primaris Marines, and so the Black Consuls are once again a powerful tool of the Imperium. They are likely one of the unusually few chapters now made up primarily of Primaris Marines, as their chapter was so devastated previously. Their current official structure and leadership is not clearly documented, although it seems likely that any of the veterans who survived their extermination at Hive Godeth will have most probably taken positions of leadership, possibly even being upgraded to Primaris, similarly to Marnius Kalgar of the Ultramarines. But the chapter's vaporization at Hive Godeth is a humiliating defeat that will never be forgotten by the Black Consuls. The Forgotten Wars are more of a period of humiliation more than anything else, so much so that the Dark Angels do not really speak of it. The battle cry of the Sons of the Lion is supposed to be never forget, never forgive, apparently though, not in every instance. Rumours lead the Dark Angels, along with two successor chapters, to begin a campaign, one that will ultimately prove to be harrowing. The world of Lemnos was reportedly engaged in a bitter civil war over mining rights. However, Imperial tithes were being met, so it was not deemed necessary for the Imperium to intervene, and the planetary governor should handle the situation as he saw fit. For the Dark Angels though, the code related to this affair that the messages had been sent through was a battle code used by the Dark Angels, and thus met the conditions for their suspicion of it being related to one of their fallen. Now, if you are not aware of what the fallen are, a brief history. At the end of the Horus Heresy, Lionel Johnson, Primarch of the Dark Angels, returned to their homeworld of Caliban, only to discover that one of his most loyal friends and brothers had been consumed by Chaos, along with all the Marines on the homeworld. This led to a cataclysmic bombardment that literally broke the planet, and resulted in the Lion, along with all the traitors, being sucked into the warp. The fate of the Primarch unknown, the Fallen scattered through time and space, forming a very dark and fascinating sect of traitor marines who may form small groups or operators, lone wolves commanding legions of cultists. Ancient, powerful traitor marines existing since the very dawn of the Age of the Imperium. However, this is a matter of immense shame and paranoia on behalf of the Dark Angels, who believe that if this fact were to become widely known, it would doom them to near certain obliteration by the Inquisition and Loyalist Astartes. And so they hope by purging their records and spending significant effort to track down and exterminate any detected fallen before anybody else finds them, they hope to conceal these matters from the Imperium at large, and also hope that in doing so they may locate clues that will lead them to rediscover their revered Father Primarch, the Lion himself. So history lesson over, this is why the Dark Angels were so interested in this communication from Lemnos. From the very beginning, unthinkable losses began to occur. While they had some small success in achieving an initial objective, the Dark Angels found that some of their marines in Terminator armor were being curiously put down. To lose Angels of Vengeance Terminators was baffling to the Dark Angels. These were veteran warriors in near impervious armor who had previously survived titanic weaponry on planetary wars, yet now they were being picked off by some rogue soldier amid a crew of ramshackle mining mercenaries. None of it made any sense. Through the Dark Angels' appallingly harsh interrogation methods by their chaplains, their initially captured target, known as the Mauler, revealed himself to be Brother Citrix. No idea how to pronounce that. He was indeed a fallen angel, now forcibly returned. He would reveal yet more locations of fallen scattered across systems in the Gothic sector. What began to become apparent was that the name of the figure known as Cypher was mentioned often. Their search for the fallen had taken years, but would expand to become a sprawling search decades long, until they came to a densely populated planet known as Brigia or Brigia. Forming what appeared to be a solid tactical plan, Grandmaster Person deployed the Angels of Redemption and the Lion's Sable, who used a drop pod dreadnought assault to smash heavy bunkers and penetrate the defences here. Readying for what should have been a straightforward second stage assault to crush the remaining defenders and capture the suspected fallen, Cypher would make his appearance in the line of the unforgiven Dark Angels. The desire to capture him drew away the reserves of Terminators, who teleported to surround him, where their previous engagements throughout the Gothic sector had been little more than formalities and skirmish fights. This was now turning into a full-scale siege battle. And this was when things would become far more serious, as the fallen of this world, not Cypher, would bring his unexpected reserves. Chaos Terminators of the Alpha Legion would teleport in to aid the defense, and vast swathes of cultists would pour forth like a tsunami of corruption. Grandmaster Person had not anticipated any of this, least of all with his forces stretched so thinly throughout the sector. This war taking place across the bunker installation was becoming far more intense and increasingly destructive to the Unforgiven. Cypher would escape, and despite the best efforts of the Dark Angels, they were unable to secure their prize. The remaining Loyalists would dig their heels in and continue to grind through the cultist hordes. The traitors and Loyalists were relatively evenly matched, but the fury and spitting rage of the Dark Angels would be what ultimately tipped the scales of battle in their favour. The whole engagement, though, and the apparent close involvement between the Chaos Marines and this fallen was raising a lot of unwanted interest. The Dark Angels' fortress world, the Rock, was already having to excuse questions being communicated to it from Holy Terror. Why were they conducting operations so far outside of their designated operational sector? Librarians had traced further signals to the twin planets of Coctus 1 and 2, and these were planets that skirted the edges of the Eye of Terror, not consumed by it, but certainly periodically enveloped by its storms. Travelling here was already forbidden by the Imperium, but an inner council of the Unforgiven would discuss such considerations. And so it was deemed necessary for the Angels to travel to and explore the possibility of fallen inhabiting these worlds, and perhaps Cypher even had retreated to here. The Dark Angels and their closely connected successor chapters burned to retaliate and respond to the unacceptable losses inflicted upon them at Brigia, and how Cypher had slipped through their fingers. The single cruiser, the Sable Lion's Fury of Caliban, was sent into the violent warp mists surrounding the world, containing companies from the Dark Angels, Angels of Vengeance, Redemption, and Lion's Sable. They successfully ran the gauntlet of the warp storms, but readings and communications were disrupted. What they found were worlds undeniably corrupted by the warp. Even the inert surroundings of the environment, rocks with twisted faces, disturbing symbols, and logic-defying visions and structures. But worse, they would discover what appeared to be a corrupted mirror image of the rock itself, a parody of their fortress adorned with human remains mangled Astartes armor. This was surely a foul den of the fallen, but the warp storms were by now already becoming more aggressive and unstable. Grandmaster Persson deemed it necessary to attack and sent in a second ship. This was the beginning of the Forgotten Wars, a seemingly unending, raging battle that the Unforgiven would pour as many as half the Dark Angels, Angels of Redemption, and three companies of Angels of Vengeance, as well as the entirety of the Lion Sable chapter. Yet while they poured such sheer brute power into crushing the fallen here in this mocking bastion of treachery, the storms around the planets only grew worse. The Loyalists would obliterate the infested dens of cultists and renegades alike, always moving forward, never relenting, as they crossed the continents of both planets. Cypher continued to evade them, he even sent them messages warning that this was all but a trap. As the warp storms continued to crash like mighty waves across both planets, Master Persson had to finally admit that perhaps Cypher was speaking the truth, and that this was a deadly folly of a campaign. Issuing a retreat, they knew time was short to pull out of the region and escape being consumed by the war. The Lion Sable, though, who had committed their entire chapter to the campaign, refused. Stubborn determination was an ingrained trait for the Dark Angels and their successors, and the Lions were no exception. Persson, though, had a doubt. He had to understand the reason for the Lion's refusal, and commanding the rest of the fleet to clear out of the storms, he returned to the planet with his bodyguards. While the fleet would emerge safely, Copters 1 and 2 would be consumed by the Eye of Terror. They were lost, along with the Grand Master and the Lion Sable. Worse still, the returning Loyalists who evaded detection by the warp disturbances were shocked to discover that their campaign that had for them seemed to occupy only a few years had in fact within real space been over 1,000 years. Cypher would continue to evade the Angels, but not before he would mysteriously return to them some of their most revered relics, the Lion Helm and Sword of Secrets. The whole campaign had been a crushing failure, and in keeping with the Dark Angels' methods of shielding the Imperium at large from their less-than-official accounts, it was deemed perhaps better that the considerable losses and failure to achieve any actual constructive outcome from their campaign would not be mentioned and purged from their records. A mysteriously convenient plasma explosion would unfortunately damage their records, and anyway, the Imperium was facing a suffocating assault by orcs and assassination attempts on the Lords of Terror. The Dark Angels' rumblings would not be at the forefront of anyone's mind. Indeed, the few inquisitional representatives sent to investigate the activities of the Dark Angels met with a series of extremely unfortunate accidents. A regrettable tragedy, to be sure. Unsurprisingly, the Forgotten Wars are preferred by the Dark Angels to be left as such. The hypocrisy of so many in the Imperium knows no bounds, to be sure. And so penultimately, we look at the humbling of Thrin. Now, the Iron Warriors, even before transitioning to Chaos, were a legion who believed in long-planned assaults. They would take time to ensure that when their attacks were finally executed, they would hit with such masterful calculation and unrestrained brutality that nothing could withstand or survive them. Only surrender or absolute obliteration. Although, to be honest, that sounds like a lot of Space Marine legions. So the tale of the humbling of Thrin would surely become a textbook example for Imperial nobles and governors of the extreme and tangible dangers of abject arrogance. End Thrin was well known as being something of a genius of planetary governorship. He oversaw Inviolus, his dynasty's planet fortress network. He boasts that his home planet is resultantly now unassailable and impregnable. The citizenry can relax, for all is well by his hand and his planning, especially now their fortress network is up and operational. They're safe, they should enjoy this newfound and rare peace of mind. Unfortunately for Thrin, agents of the Alpha Legion operate in this sector, and they decide that they will relay this claim to their Iron Warriors brothers, who very much enjoy a good puzzle, and to formulate a plan to crack so-called invulnerable defences. Before long, Lord Mandrak has made warp translation and is in system at the head of a considerably large fleet. Yet instead of attacking Inviolus directly as Thrin had planned, his defences were focused around short, powerfully aggressive assaults. The Iron Warriors instead attack the nearby agri-world of Dalathro's Rest. The primary food supplier of the Inviodus system, Dalathro's Rest, however, is also very well defended by the Astra Militarum, and so instead Mandrak simply bombards it from orbit, whilst launching unrelenting boarding actions against every craft bound for Inviodus, blockading the planet and preventing any supplies reaching it. Within the year, the people of Inviodus are crippled by starvation. As per Thryn's plan, though, they're able to hold out until reinforcements are able to arrive. A company of Mentor Legion Space Marines does indeed arrive to assist the planet's defense force, except that by now, Mandrak has ensured that Inviolus's half-starved defense forces are extremely easy prey for his teleporting annihilation squads. The populace is crushed, enslaved, and Thryn's fate unknown, perhaps murdered by his own raging people or brutally butchered by the Iron Warriors. It's largely irrelevant. The planet is seized and repurposed as a Chaos base. An astonishingly poor defense and slow retaliation by the Imperium, once again showing that for all the grandiose battles and heroic engagements, the Imperium is quick to champion and promote for the indoctrination of its citizenry, so many worlds can be crushed with the lightest of efforts, no rescuing forces, poorly constructed defense planning, and a pathetic and almost inevitable failure from start to finish. While not the most dramatic or even the most important of engagements, the humbling of Thryn sits as just one of the many best examples of the abject failings of the Imperium and how its entire system is poorly organized and leaves a vast amount of Imperial civilian worlds just open to absolute annihilation at any moment. So you can take the defeat of Thryn and Inviolus as really representative of many of the other defeats the Imperium has suffered. I include it here really as a symbolic failure of the larger failings of the Imperium itself. Cadia. Just saying the word would make a guardsman's skin itch and crawl. While some would cling to the description of the planet itself breaking before the Cadian guard did, this is surely only the Imperium and its indoctrinated drones clinging onto former pride that was not just wounded, but absolutely crushed and broken by the annihilation of Cadia. Because Cadia had not been simply some Imperial outpost or a heavily fortified Imperial bastion, it was the bastion. It was the citadel that oversaw the Eye of Terror, arguably the Astra Militarum's display piece, its model of what Imperial fortresses should aspire to. To see it not only crushed by traitors, cracked, and simply broken by the most abhorrent forces in the eyes of humanity, because planets are ruined and destroyed and overrun as a depressing regularity in the history of the Imperium, but this was much worse. The fall of Cadia forced the eyes and the attention of the Imperium. It brought their doubts and fears quickly into sharp focus that they were not safe, that they were not secure, that they could be reached, and that the enemy could not only assault and raid their worlds, but raise them. Abaddon, favourite of his former master Horus, had been launching his Black Crusades for millennia, but it was the 13th which would be vastly more devastating. Cadia was and had always been a keystone in the Imperium's defences surrounding the Eye of Terror. It stood forever on alert, ready to stand and fight on a moment's notice, strong in faith, strong in flesh, and strong in its material defences. Shock troops, brightly coloured banners of Nighthouses, sigils of Astartes, scuttling Mechanicus, and shining fleur-de-lis of Sororitas stood proudly awaiting the foreseen battle fleet. They only had to wait for it to arrive. Millions would perish in the first assault, many more in the slaughter that would follow. Twisted, wrecked war machines, broken flesh, and shattered minds and souls would be thrown together in a mighty tempest of war, rarely seen as the two came together. Cadia battled until its defenders had nothing left to fight with, and then continued to fight. It was the darkness, though, that always threatened to tip the scales. It was never an even fight, never a case of simply measuring up equipment and manpower. Abaddon brought with him weapons that couldn't be countered with munitions and sharpened blades. He brought dark whispered promises, words that would turn brothers against one another, blessings and damnations. Bunkers and bastions would collapse into infighting, tearing into one another, the lost clawing with nail and fingers at the faces and flesh of those that they had called friends for years previously. Close quarter blind murder, grinding each other into the ferrocrete until every surface was not a coarse grey but a shining crimson red. Their screams, their agony, and their torment echoing through the Immaterium. They were the Immaterium. They were the cause of their own destruction, their own pain, their own hate, rage and agony. The Cadian forces had no doubt that Abaddon and his crusade had no intention of sidestepping Cadia. He would either break it or he would flee, as he had so many times before. The men and women of the Guard endured every minute of every hour of every day that the assault continued for, until they hoped reinforcements could arrive and aid in sending the Chaos minions reeling back into the Eye. Cadia Secundus had weathered the initial devastating assault upon Cadia, and this was where the combined forces hoped to make their stand, with Scuttling Mechanicus trying to tinker and pray life back into the machines. If only they'd brought more incense, they surely cursed. Guard troops worked without rest to improve and secure defences. The previously well-organised divisions of Imperial forces, Astartes, Knights and Sororitas, were by now mixed in with the regular Guard. This can only have been immensely positive and morale-boosting for the mortal men and women of the Cadian Guard to stand in such proximity and presence of the Imperium's elite fighting forces. Forces like the Dark Angels and Sisters repaired and prepped what they could, and the Imperial Guard continued their important battle drills of marching themselves up and down the square, hoping not to be randomly flogged for some minor rule incursion. As Abaddon's real assault began, any ships standing in their path were scattered like toys as they swept through, focused on driving through to the heart of Cadia and the remaining resistance. The blackened cruisers of the Despoiler, bloated bile-leeching plague ships, cabal vessels of the Thousand Suns, and leviathans of the World Eaters, among them the Will of Eternity, the last of the creations from the War in Heaven, known as the Blackstone Fortresses. The reports of such an object approaching threw those on Cadia into what could be described as either an urgent sense of focus or a blind panic. The defenders had been expecting a much more conventional assault. Knowing now what they faced, Mechanicus and every adept were hurriedly pushing to try and complete their restoration of something known as the Null Array, an amalgamation of Void Shield and Gellerfield that they hoped could dissipate the energy of such a warp beam as emitted by the Will of Eternity. They worked until many would physically collapse, but it was not enough. They needed more time, and their time was up. A contingent of Space Wolves led by Sven Bloodhow suggested that an alternative solution would be to attempt to disable the vessel by a direct boarding. A near-suicidal proposal, but with few alternatives available, it seemed a legitimate option. As the Astartes left, their contact was immediately lost, and when the Will of Eternity finally approached, it was clear that they had failed in their task. Their sacrifice, a forlorn hope. Yet as the ancient weapons platform fired its blazing energy at Cadia, cheers would erupt, as the weapon's power dissipated in the atmosphere. The Mechanicus had successfully activated their protective shielding, but as the dropships began to fall, the cheering would soon cease. A storm of fire enveloped the invaders and defenders as cannon, missile, energy weapons and explosions engulfed the world. Shields were impacted, some collapsed or crackled as the relentless barrages rained down upon them. Most ground-to-air defences were simply firing blind at this point, as so many enemy rained down upon them, it made little to any difference to aim. No matter where you would have looked, the picture was the same. Roaring weapons, screaming horror, the air acrid and choking, filled with poisonous gases, blackened smoke from weapons and machines of war. In sections, the Guard pushed the invaders back, but in others, demons screaming incomprehensible sounds that tore the very air, even the fabric of reality, climbed the walls, dived down upon mortals, rending and eviscerating them. Some guardsmen threw down their weapons and ran, only to be either vaporized by weapons or pinned to the floor by claws and immaterium made real. Most soldiers, though, were too well drilled and indoctrinated, consumed by the events going on around them. They felt no fear, only loyalty and duty and determination. Defeat may not have been an option for them, but it may be an inevitability. Most guardsmen would see their fate and take it head on, running screaming into the enemy in the name of the Emperor of Man. The fighting seemed to never cease, no matter where you were. Hordes of unrelenting, uncaring cultists, as well as the demons and traitors, came upon the defenders. Waves of blood and flesh that were shredded but never ceased. Autocannons would overheat, weapons would run dry, and then they would be overwhelmed. It was pure carnage, an endless tide of hatred breaking over and over again against the defenders. A week had passed, and still the assault continued, unabated. The Guard were weary, much of the machinery had already been pushed well beyond the amount of consistent use that it had ever been expected to face. The horrors never left the minds of the mortals, though. And as the seventh day had come within the shrine of Saint Morican, the demon forges roared forth as they drowned the shrine in boiling blood, and scores of battle sisters were boiled alive in their own armour or swept away, drowning in blood. Bone and rubble were indistinguishable. The next critical turn of events would be the emergence of the Imperial Fist's battle station, the Phalanx. Having completely destroyed the demonic invaders, the new Third Company under the command of Garrodon had purged the entities and was ready to fight. The Phalanx, now in orbit, brought its weapon batteries online, and Dark Enemy were already reacting to its presence. The Legion of the Damned vanished without anyone noticing how or when it had occurred. The Phalanx focused itself on the Blackstone Fortress, the Will of Eternity. Garrodon engaged many enemy ships, but its most powerful guns were inoperable. There would be no retreat. This is where they would stand. The Phalanx held its course into the obsidian maw of the Will of Eternity. As the two gargantuan space vessels grazed and ground against one another, the dying shields enabled Garrodon to fire into the fortress at close range, damaging its side. They were succeeding, and they sought to destroy this Xenos abomination. Salvo after salvo fired against the Will of Eternity until it began to crack and splits appeared in the Blackstone core. Garrodon immediately had the Phalanx move away as blinding purple light exuded from the centre of the fortress, the spreading crack consuming anything near to it. The Will of Eternity broke. By the time any person looking had had their blinded vision returning, a third of Abaddon's fleet had simply vanished. Far more were strewn as broken wreckage, drifting in the void, and all that remained of the ancient fortress was a lifeless husk orbiting Cadia. What seemed like victory was merely an opportunity. The best they could hope for even now was mere survival. By the next day, the Imperial forces were attempting to assess their remaining power, and reinforcements were arriving to Cadia, if only appearing in small dribs and drabs. Some breaking from the warp only to face instant annihilation at the hands of the Chaos Fleet. Others came into the protecting shelter of the Phalanx and were able to lend their refreshing strength to the Imperial defenders. This morning was when Belisarius Kall would reveal his disturbing assertion that Abaddon's Black Crusades, long seen as continual failures by the Imperium, had far greater purpose than any may have previously imagined. That in fact Abaddon was seeking to destroy the mysterious Black Pylons, and that his obsession with Cadia was about much more than irrational pride and ego. Kall would explain how Abaddon intended to destroy these Blackstone pylons that were literally holding the galaxy together and preventing the warp from spilling out, consuming it. That the destruction of these pylons would allow the Immaterium and Materium to bleed together, as we ourselves know from Eldar mythology was once the original state of the galaxy, and since the most ancient times sealed away, separating the warp from real space so as to protect its mortal inhabitants. Kall did not tell them everything, but it was enough to know that the pylons were Abaddon's objective, and that they also could potentially be his downfall. One concerning fact became abundantly clear to all, though: retreat and escape from Cadia using the Phalanx as a protective base to evacuate the inhabitants and forces of Cadia was no longer an option. The planet and its black pylons must be held without question. For the Cadian forces, this had perhaps become, appropriately, their hill to die on. As the remaining forces pulled together and bolstered what defences remained, ammo was checked, guns cleared for operation, the scattered remnants of Astartes pulling together now in one asserting force. The living Saint Celestine was gliding overhead, waiting to bring down fire and retribution against the abhorrent enemies of the Emperor, as did her sisters on the ground. Dropships began to appear, though, through the hazy smoke-filled horizons. Their final battle had begun. The Cadian troops did their duty, firing until their last moments. None would retreat from this battle. They would stand here, and they would die here. They all understood their duty. They felt no fear, only bitter determination and faith. The Phalanx, meanwhile, bombarded the outer zones, attempting to stop the ever-approaching waves of insane cultists snatched from worlds driven by hatred of the false Emperor. They came from hives, from mining colonies. Their pitiful and ragged figures were ripped to shreds, but still they came, their single focus upon the pylons. Celestine and her seraphim hunted down the dark warpsmiths and demon engines, purging them with holy fire. The Black Legion itself, though, advanced further south from the fighting of the cultists' wave. The Legion of Horus came miles wide and twice as deep. Over hours of gunfire like hail, the Black Legion continued encircling and tightening their grip on the fragmented Astartes, the guard, and their command. The day soon became night, and each hour only brought death in the hundreds, if not thousands. The Battle Sisters in the fight to the north held strong. Celestine and Imperial faith was all they needed to channel the light of the Emperor into battle. But they still paid a heavy cost in blood for their strength and resolve. Many more soldiers and their officers were driven to insanity, as was always the danger when engaged with the forces of the Dark Gods. Often this led to confusion, retreats, poor orders, soldiers not knowing what it was that they should be doing, and breaks in lines occurring as a result. Hesitation brought annihilation. Then Abaddon came, along with his bringers of despair, teleporting into the heart of the defense command and slaughtering dozens of elite soldiers in moments. Sergeant Kell, clinging to the Cadian 8th standard, would stare into the eyes of the despoiler, spitting blood as he uttered the words, "Cadia stands." The claw of Abaddon tightening around his neck until Kell felt his vertebrae crack into dust and the void consumed him. Abaddon had crushed the southern defense, and the fields containing the pylons were overrun. The Astartes standing between the Black Legion and their prize would dig in to brace for the tide of darkness. Yet even as they stood firmly, the Imperial Fists among them were facing with ever more regularity numbers that were far from an even battle. A breakwater they were, but being consumed by the waves of Legion that fell upon them was an inevitability. Abaddon and his Black Legion pounded onward, breaking into the caverns where Kall and the Necron Trazin were activating the pylons. Trazin would unleash long-held Imperial forces from his Tesseract Labyrinth, and Ultramarines and Vostroians, including Inquisitor Greyfax, would spring forth. The Ultramarines needed only to see the symbols of Chaos and the Eagle of the Imperium to know which direction they would begin their fighting, and without hesitation, they were immersed into the chaos of the battle. The human Vostroians, though, took longer to gather themselves, confused and dizzy from their emergence out of the pocket portal realm, yet the forces were enough to resist the tide of darkness. The pylons of Blackstone would begin to become activated, dissipating the Chaos Demons, as the power of the Blackstone was an anathema to them. Yet the unforeseen side effect of this was also to weaken some of the Emperor's, most notably the Living Saint, who was battling Abaddon. Celestine was saved from his blade only by the psychic rage of Inquisitor Greyfax, who had finally brought her attention to the battle. Abaddon, eyes burning like white-hot pins of pain from this psychic assault, was determined to see this angel of the Emperor slaughtered, but the tattered remnants of the Cadian 8th would not have it, and they blocked his onslaught to protect Celestine as the blockade of men and women was torn to pieces by the rampaging Chaos Master. Celestine had been brought the briefest of moments that she required to evade death at the hands of Abaddon. The pylons by now were beginning to power into life and were pushing back against the wall. Any remaining demons were cast back into the Imperium, disintegrating. Above in the space orbiting Cadia, navigators became disorientated and the phalanx void shields collapsed as anything requiring connection to the Immaterium was being negated by the power of the Blackstone pylons. Within the cavern, the only battle that had any meaning now was between Abaddon and Saint Celestine. All had become instinctively aware that the entire battle rested upon their hands and the outcome of their duel. Any interference was countered by either side with a price paid in blood. The Necron Trazin was curious by the historical events unfolding, but was also bored of his involvement in the affairs of these mortal entities. His only concern as he teased a Tesseract cube in his fingers was which mortal figures he would take away as a trophy for eternal preservation. As the fight between Celestine and Abaddon raged, she whipped around him, blade dancing and lacerating his armor, his claw deflecting and thrusting toward her, hoping to snatch and crush her body, tearing it in two. The Cadians continued to harass and aid the Living Saint, and Abaddon began to become acutely aware that the Blackstone Pylon's influence on the warp meant that their time was becoming shorter. His frustrated conclusion came as he ordered a withdrawal. Abaddon had seemingly lost. He had sought the annihilation of the defenders of the gateway out of the eye, yet the Cadian Guard and its defenders had stood strong, but paid heavily for the privilege. Yet an unease gripped some of the Imperial defenders. As the honourable heroes of the cavernous battle regained their composure, the fighting on the surface continued, but the traitors only sought to collect their war machines. Any flesh figures of the cultists were left to their fate of being put down like cattle. Captain Garrodon regrouped whatever remained of his third company of Imperial Fists, the dark comedy was not lost on him that they had only been aboard the Phalanx as they had been deemed too newly congregated after the annihilation of the previous third company at Hydra Caudatus. Yet here they stood, having suffered yet another near total obliteration. Yet this time, they had prevailed, and the few who remained had nothing more to prove. They would be raised to high positions within the third company as it would be rebuilt again. The impossible had been achieved, a glorious victory for the Imperium of Mankind and the Emperor. Abaddon was incensed by what appeared to be, for now, their failure. Yet standing aboard the ancient vessel, the Vengeful Spirit, he would sound out the death knell of Cadia. Warpsmiths would hear the order from Abaddon. Plasma drive sparked and powered into life. The ancient fortress, it moved at a glacial pace at first, but gained ever-increasing momentum until it was hurtling toward the planet. The fleet of the Despoiler sped away from the planet, pulling back to the safety of the Eye, as the Blackstone Fortress spiraled down toward Cadia. Abaddon mused, "Nothing can defy the will of Chaos forever. Nothing defied his will forever." The Phalanx made a token attempt to destroy the Will of Eternity by firing its batteries, but it had little to no effect. On Cadia itself, none could escape the screeching, warp-tearing scream of the fortress as it descended down upon the planet, as the winds of immense atmospheric pressure whirled and whipped around the impending strike. The Blackstone Fortress made its impact on Cadia. While they had been victorious in battle, the defense of Cadia had been a Pyrrhic victory. It had been a victory in spirit but not in truth, and worse, Abaddon had cast his final blow upon the world as his fleet departed without a care back into the warp, and his final blow would be fatal. The impact of the ancient fortress upon Cadia was literally world-ending. Thousands perished instantly anywhere near the impact, mountains turned to dust, seas were vaporized, the very geology of the planet shifted and came under immense pressures. Towers and citadels fell from the planet-wide earthquakes that cracked and tore the hardest ferrocrete bastions apart like matchsticks. Firestorms engulfed ancient forests, magma and lava spewed forth across the surface of the planet. The planet could only be described as looking like a hellish apocalypse. The ordeal was not over. Those who had not been instantly vaporized or torn apart by fire and winds so powerful that they would tear the skin right off of a man, lungs flattened and sucked of their air, words of prayer from the faithful stolen from them in the moment of death. Then came the worst of it. The Kryan Fault would break open the planet's very crust and began to split apart. Cadia was a storm of conflicting elements, simultaneously drowning, lashed by winds of impossible force, consumed by fire, or crushed by the earth of the planet itself. Cadia was dead. Even this, though, would not be the end. The pylons that Abaddon had so desperately wanted to destroy began to shatter against the natural forces tearing the planet apart, and as they fell, all that could be heard was the laughter of dark gods. Nothing could stop the warp from enveloping Cadia now, and demons spilled forth as the materium became immaterium. No pawns of the gods projected into real space, these were the true servants of the warp, fed and fueled by its raw, unending power. No victory could be held on Cadia. The planet and all it had stood for was lost to the darkness of the immaterium. The weakest psychers were simply consumed, but for Greyfax and Celestine, they were once again invigorated by the power of the warp coursing through them, and they would use this power to aid in the coming exodus, as they led the defenders who were able to escape the surface. Landing craft and transport vessels would struggle to fly across the challenging conditions engulfing the remains of the planet, but those who could ferried the survivors off to the Imperial Fist battle station, the Phalanx. Losses continued to mount and the evacuation was a broken, miserable affair, with many pilots landing to lift off survivors with immense skill, only to be picked off and torn to pieces as they attempted to break out of the planet's space by winged demons, breaking them apart and exposing those inside to their fate. Elsewhere, order was not the word you would use to describe the situation. Some evacuations turned into full-blown riots as officers ordered soldiers to fire into other crowds of soldiers, friend or foe, who knew which was which anymore. Insanity, betrayal, heresy, consuming of mortal minds. At the sight of Celestine and the Astartes, it was a running battle to retreat and escape. Remaining Sororitas fought with fury against demonic hordes, and guardsmen gritted their teeth and attempted to put down whatever nightmares came thrashing towards them. It was looking more and more like the evacuation would turn into a horrific slaughter. But the Cadian 8th would step up again, and they formed a line of defiance that allowed the Sisters and Astartes to be safely evacuated from the surface. As they flew away from the Cadian guardsmen, who were moments away from being entirely consumed by horror, the only words screaming through the gunfire, steel and claws clashing below were "Cadia stands." Cadia had been a planet of some 850 million human souls, but barely 3 million were able to be lifted from the planet, and even as the battered fleet along the phalanx travelled to leave the now expanded Eye of Terror, the warp carving a great gash into real space, by the time the fleet reached real space and was preparing to engage warp drives, they had lost another 13 ships in making their escape, amounting to the loss of some 500,000 souls. Cadia stands as one of the most valiant defence efforts in the Imperium's history, for it has many, but unlike some others, the ultimate outcome was one of outright defeat and total destruction. Still, as many would rightly point out, the planet itself was broken before the will of the Cadian Guard was.
To each of us on this day falls a single task. All that the Emperor requires of you, guardsmen, is you stand in line and die fighting. This is what we do best. We die standing. The Golden Throne and Terror lie far from us here, yet know that the Emperor's hand is on your shoulders today. You have fought and displayed bravery and loyalty far above your calling as guardsmen. You have faced horrors none could imagine, and you will face them again. I am honored to have led you. Enemies of the Imperium, hear me. You have come here to die. The immortal Emperor of all mankind is with us, and we are invincible. His soldiers will strike you down. His war machines will crush you. His guns will bring down the sky itself upon you. You cannot win. The Emperor is our greatest weapon. This is our day for victory.